Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. So, you know, it's been brought to my attention that we are being heard in Green Bay. Good morning to those of you who are in Green Bay, and welcome. And I want you to get used to what we are going to be doing on the air. I thank you and welcome you to the Earl Ingram Show. My co-host Sandy Williams, who's on here every Monday and Friday with me, and the subjects that we'll be broaching from time to time. But Sandy, clearly, there is pressure being applied to politicians to bring the jobs back. And it was similar to an old song during the Vietnam War that was made by, and I forgot the woman's name, but it was about bring the boys home, bring the boys home. Now they're saying bring the jobs back, bring the jobs back. I'm a guy who didn't want to see the jobs leave. Never understood at the time why they had to leave, since it impacted my life in the middle of my life and many others as we watched the nation, like ours, that was number one in everything just about in your and my lifetime. And we saw us impacted and affected, and maybe it's one of the reasons why, Sandy, the hate for China, because people saw jobs move over to China, and they blame the Chinese for taking our jobs. They were blamed for taking our jobs.
That's the reverse way of looking at it. But looking at it the other way, our businesses gave those jobs to China. But it was all part of this transition from the United States being the only vibrant economy in the world after World War II. And as the decades rolled on after World War II, as after we got through the 50s and the 60s and we got into the 70s, the rest of the world...
Catching up.
And they began, the supply chain, the supply of parts developed a very global aspect. And we had manufacturers, Bosch. Bosch is a name for a German company that makes lots of electrical things that go into automobiles, mechanical and electrical things in automobiles. You can't find a car, whether it's an American brand or a foreign brand, that doesn't have Bosch things in it, okay? The Apple phone started getting made in the early part of this century, and it's made in China. Its accelerometers are made in Germany. Its chips are made in Taiwan. It's assembled in China, but its parts come from all over the world. And almost everything that we make, regardless of where it's made, has a supply chain of parts that is sourced from wherever it can be best sourced from the standpoint of cost and reliability. And when we have a world market in which we can source our supplies for our parts, we can pit a manufacturer here in America, can pit those suppliers against one another, both for price, for quality, and the reliability of the supply. All three of those things are fundamentally important in the parts supply chain. And if we decide to onshore all of our parts, we will limit the number of competitors who can make those parts. We will lose the ability to have competition on reliability and quality in the same manner as we did in the past, because we won't have as many suppliers. And so there will be things that will suffer in the process, and the cost of the good will go down. Right now, we don't have many workers looking for jobs. The idea of onshoring a bunch of things now and bringing a bunch of things back to the United States for workers will beg the need for workers. And to be honest with you, the current situation we've got is what gives me optimism about whether we're going to have a recession, or secondly, whether it will be a deep recession, because I think we have turned the corner in our employment market, And employers have come to realize how important employees are, how important it is that they can count on the employees when they need them, when the market is rising and doing well. They learned an ugly lesson after the pandemic when they left our manufacturers here in America, left billions of dollars on the table because they couldn't make products. They couldn't, therefore couldn't sell them. And the whole reason was because of a lack of the workers that they needed. It was hit most heavily in the service industry, but it has been throughout. And so I think America's marketplace has changed, and I think we're reverting more in the direction of what you and I knew when we came into it, which is we're going to find people, there already are, advertising, we will train you for your job. They're competing on price, they're competing on training programs, and they have realized that the importance of capital labor.
So, Sandy, it's safe to say that it's short-sightedness on the part of those who want to see these things coming back into the country, these jobs. Certainly it will raise the standard of pay. I think that people are receiving if some of those jobs came back here. But you're saying long term.
Well, I think they are going to come back for the reason of reliability. I think that the tension and friction in the world, particularly with Russia, but as we continue to increase the amount of abrasive kinds of friction with China, people will begin to worry about the reliability of the Chinese supply chain. And so they might decide that they want to change the supply chain out of China. Now, what happened during the pandemic when that happened? A lot of those were sourced in Vietnam or India or countries other than China. So it's not terribly clear that the reliability issue will bring all of the jobs and those parts manufacturing back to the United States shores. But you know, the marketplace out there is run on these different principles. One of them is we want reliability, we want competitive prices, and we want quality.
The other part of this, Sandy, is because we don't want to play in that game of global, you know, supply chains anymore, doesn't mean that the rest of the world isn't going to continue. Does it mean that we'll be isolated?
Well, we have to continue to compete with the rest of the world in the products we make because we don't sell. The growth for almost every business, the growth in their sales is not domestic, it's foreign. And so they need to be able to compete in the foreign markets against foreign products. Every other country in the world is, very few countries will be able to onshore their supply chains, particularly for parts, because it takes a big, diverse economy to even think about doing it. Russia's talking about doing it, but everyone shakes their head and says that Russian economy is not mature enough to be able to onshore everything it needs. It's always going to be dependent on foreign sources. The same is actually true of China. China needs the international commerce. If it onshores everything, it might create a tsunami of onshoring that will destroy its economy because most of its economy is based on selling stuff offshore to other people.
Yeah, so you just kind of answered the next question I was going to ask. When you and I remember when they offshored these jobs, and it didn't happen overnight. Clearly didn't happen in a vacuum. Bringing them back is not going to happen overnight. China, they're offshoring a lot of their work. Is that what you're telling me?
No, but they do have to buy lots of things. You know, they have a very large amount of international trade. They run an international trade surplus, but they still are buying lots of things in the international, and lots of it involves parts for what they manufacture. And there is talk in the Chinese political scene about doing more onshoring to get more self-reliant. But most of that is political talk that is in response to the tensions with the United States and the notion that if sanctions were to be imposed on China like they have been on Russia, China wants to be in a position to be insulated from suffering much from that. And the fact is that with China, I've got yours and you've got mine kind of a thing. We are so entwined with them from a trade standpoint that it would be very hard to disentangle.
You know, Sandy, we've gotten used to. I remember when the first, you know you get know when you say, I remember when the first, right?
Mm.
But those, the televisions that we have now, the HD TVs.
Yeah.
When they were $8,000, right?
Right.
He wanted an HD. Connor's looking at me like, I'm making this up. But I remember the first time I saw an HD TV in the news, in the magazines, they were $8,000.
No, the fact is that...
And Sandy had one.
Almost all of our durable goods are remarkably cheaper today than they would be without international trade. Washing machines, dryers, fans, heaters, automobile, everything.
You know, I mean, we're at this point again, Sandy, where it looks like it's the right thing to do.
Which, onshoring?
Yeah. From the standpoint, if we're just looking at it from with a jaundice eye.
If we're looking at it with the eyes of nostalgia,
right,
then we can say, yes, we want to go back to that. But the world is not living in that world of nostalgia. And the supply chains all around the world are complicated. People will be working on streamlining the supply chains and making them more reliable. That could end up creating more onshoring all around the world. But the fact is that we won't get all the way to being self-reliant. And we will always have supply chains that will buy things from places that specialize in manufacturing those things.
No, nor do we really want to become self-reliant. It's what I'm hearing from you, because there's a price to be paid, even if that's the idea. We've been there once. We know what that outcome was.
Yeah.
And so we have now gotten to a point where I'll just tell you, in our lifetimes, we've seen both sides of it, right?
Well, it's just, the things evolve. And so we want it to be as it was. We think we can flick a switch and change it back. We don't have an economy run by the government. People say, how could we possibly have let all that chip manufacturing go offshore? Well, chips were a component part and a relatively less important part 30 years ago in lots of things. And they got made in the places that decided they wanted to invest in making them. And that one of those places was not the United States in terms of going very all in on focusing on.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, inflation is changing somewhat. After all these increases in interest rates, the Fed kind of knew what they were doing. Is it safe to say that?
I think shortage was a big part of the inflation, and shortages have moderated. I think a big part of the inflation was the fly up in energy costs, particularly resulting from the sanctions associated with the Ukrainian war and the sanctions on Russia that caused a huge fly up in the cost of oil, for instance. Oil has dropped way back. Oil is $60 a barrel or some such. The rate of core inflation, the core inflation is measured to and excludes from the measurement of it for of food and fuel, okay? And those are the two most volatile components that tend to be commodities, and commodities tend to fly up and down based on supply and demand in the short term. So when they strip out those two things and look at core inflation is down at 5%+ now, and it seems to be descending at a relatively good clip, at least predictably descending. I think this is all evidence that we get so used to a world that didn't involve inflation that we haven't yet developed the inflationary psychology. We didn't develop a full belief that prices were going to go up regardless. So look what's happened to the housing market. The house prices flew up for a while, but as soon as it slowed down a bit, the house market cooled quickly. used cars, prices flew up for a while. Now they're going down. So the car market has reacted quickly. And so I think what's happened is that, that inflation psychology has not taken hold. And I think that that means that we might get over this sort of inflationary period relatively quickly, because if people believe it hasn't taken hold, then they're going to wait. People are now sitting on their hands to buy a house, I'm confident, because they think the price of housing might fall some more. So that's not an inflationary psychology. And I think the same is true for your used cars. People used to think, well, I've got to buy it today because the price is going up. Now people understand, you know, the price is kind of moderating, going down. That's a very important factor in whether we have inflation or not. Now, my view is that if we defeat inflation this time, we can continue to have this non-inflationary psychology. If it comes back in the next couple of months, then I think people are going to begin to believe, yes, indeed, we do have embedded inflation.
So what's an accepted inflationary...
Well, the Fed, when I was younger, we used to talk about 3% being accepted. That dropped to 2%. And currently, the Fed talks about 2% as the target inflation level. But economists have always thought there ought to be some inflation. Deflation causes people to stop buying things and wait. And so you don't want deflation. And so if the option is deflation or inflation, everyone says, yeah, let's have some inflation. And so 2-3% is, I think, the Fed has recently, and observers of the Fed more recently have been saying maybe the Fed's going to jump that up to 3%. But my sense is that it's coming down pretty rapidly, and my sense is that 2% is going to be the target.
So which is something that, based on where we are now, could be obtainable, because a couple months ago it was 11%.
Yes,
I mean that's a major, that, you know, that I don't know, Sandy, if that's ever happened, that you can, that it drops that quickly.
I can't tell you, but it dropped relatively quickly in the 80s when the psychology finally dropped. It all has to do with psychology, and if the mass psychology is that prices are going to go up, you're going to have inflation. If the mass psychology is that prices are stagnant or going down, you don't have inflation, and it goes away. And so much of this inflation was related to fuel costs and food costs, both of which were heavily impacted by the war in Ukraine and just by circumstances. They were, and then also the pandemic and the shortages that were caused by the supply chain, and which were in many respects caused by the pandemic, the recession and the inflation and the layoffs of employees that occurred during the pandemic, which the world manufacturing market had trouble replacing.
So it was a perfect storm of events.
Yes.
That created this. Let's say that storm of events had not occurred, and we would have still been rolling along like we have since 2008. Or would that have been inconceivable? I don't know what the longest growth period is.
Well, we were laying the seeds for inflation with the Trump tax reduction, which was pouring accelerant onto the marketplace, which was driving the price of stocks up. When you have a huge fly up in the stock market, you have an increase in perceived wealth by lots of people. That increase in perceived wealth can cause a fly up in, for instance, the purchase price of houses, which it was doing. So, we might have been headed towards something that was inflationary, and it might have been a more embedded sort of inflation that would have been harder to squelch. But instead, what we had was a flare-up of inflation, which I think which exceeded the psychology of inflation. It frightened people, and I think that the perfect storm also occurred for squelching it rapidly. Lots of people got frightened about recession. They got frightened about the circumstances. Interest rates went up quickly. And so we poured some pretty quick kinds of decelerant water on the fire.
You know, and thank goodness, because one of the last things I think our nation needed right now would be a recession.
Yeah, quite frankly, I'm more optimistic, and the reason I'm more optimistic is—
Well, you've been that way from the beginning.
I've always thought that we were going to have a recession. The question was when, And of course, we always will. There is always out the windshield in some distance. There is a recession on the horizon, but no one knows when. And I thought that we were heading in that direction when we were overfeeding the fire of the boom.
All right, gotta go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to the Early Room Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. My guest is Sandy Williams. He's a co-host on Mondays and Fridays. Sandy, Ukraine. You know, all over the weekend, there was just talking about how barbaric it was that Russia hit this apartment that had all of these people and, I don't know, killed 40 people, 40, 50 people, and maybe 60 others wounded. And some, you would say, is that all? I mean, when you shoot a rocket into a heavily populated,
Yeah, I think if we try to be objective observers about what's going on in Ukraine, the number of civilian fatalities would objectively, I think, looks much more like collateral damage, unintended damage. I think that the damage that has been done to the infrastructure, which obviously has a secondary and very damaging effect on the public, on the civilian population, by knocking out the electric systems. That has been purposeful, and it clearly has been designed to try and put pressure on the government by making the people so uncomfortable. And obviously, depriving a large group of people of electricity will kill some of them. There might be those who are in hospitals who require electrical service that no longer is available. You don't know. But I don't think that at this point Russia is attempting to level the civilian population, because I think if that was their intent, I think they would be, the number of deaths we'd be reading about would be far higher than it is. And number two, we all have to look at this and say, what's the end game going to be here? Because if Russia were to, for instance, succeed beyond any measure of current expectation and take over all of Ukraine, they would take over a country which now is inhabited by a large number of people who must have a great deal of, they must be enemies in their heart of Russia, right? And so if Russia tried to take over Ukraine and occupy it, they would be subject to terrorism and all kinds of public disobedience, violent disobedience that would be ongoing. And we've seen that happen in lots of other places. So, I think that what Russia's focused on is the Crimea, Sevastopol, a land bridge to that, and that land bridge requires that they have the Donbass.
All right, Connor, who do we have on line one? Let's just bring him up.
It's Jacob.
Jacob, quickly.
Hey, Earl. So, yeah, the Russians will never be able to hold Ukraine. Just like, you know, the United States was never able to hold Iraq. It's like George Bush Jr. forgot how many people were killed in the first Iraq war by his father. You know, by the time we were over there occupying Iraq in the second war, there was no way in hell they would just let us take their country permanently. You know, so the Ukrainians are not going to allow Russians to do the same. And I just wanted to, you know, say that earlier you brought up the issue of the insane Trump tax cuts for the rich having helped to cause housing prices to skyrocket. I mean, that's something they don't talk about much, but it's a big issue because a lot of these houses are being bought up and being overpaid for, being overbidded on, not by individual families, but by, you know, corporations and, you know, these companies that are buying the houses to rent them out, not to live in them. So we got to remember that's Republican policies that have largely led to these housing prices being out of control. And I looked at the rent prices recently in Waukesha and Madison, and they're almost like California-level rent prices. And, you know, I used to live in Wisconsin a long time ago, and rent used to be reasonable there. So what happened? How did rent get so far out of control in places like Waukesha and Madison?
Well, rents are strictly supply and demand issues. And I think the developers have understood for quite a while that there is a shortage on the supply side of quality rental real estate. Madison, of course, has been affected substantially by the development of Epic Systems and a substantial number of high-paid young people, and it's young people primarily who are moving into apartments, early people who don't have families or early families. And so that population has put a great deal of demand on the rental markets. And so, yeah, and so housing has been an issue, and there's always been a belief. And there is this problem with rental housing. It's in short supply until it isn't. And when it isn't in short supply, rents can stagnate and go down rather quickly. So developers live with bated breath about the supply of rental housing.
You know, Sandy, I want to go back to Ukraine and what you see, what your thoughts are, because, you know, I remember early on and most of last year, you and I talking about Ukraine, and you talked about the ground war. You remember when we were early on, and you said, well, nothing's going to really take place until the ground war starts. Well, the ground war's ugly.
Well, ground wars are ugly, and you look at the data about how the Russians have armed themselves, and rather than being armed for that, they are highly and way skewed differently than the U.S. military or almost any other country with respect to the numbers of tanks, the number of armored personnel carriers, the number of artillery. I mean, it's way disproportionate to what we have because they have made their military for ground war. That's what they're all about. That's what they've experienced in the past. It's essentially a defensive kind of a military, and so from some positions at least, we ought to look at that and take some comfort that the Russians have armed themselves primarily in a defensive posture to have a big military to defend them, to defend their ground. But they have substantial capacity. And the question just will be will. You know, how much will do they have, does Putin have, and does the country have to stand behind Putin? I've also said that if this war goes on long enough, and if the Crimea goes into contest, I think we will find that Russia will be willing to hurt itself much more in order to make sure that Crimea and Sevastopol stays in their hands.
So I would ask you, as this thing slogs on, the divide between hearing what conservatives are saying, who are, the more I hear it, the more you're hearing some conservatives saying, basically, hey, we need to get out of this. We need to stop spending this money on this, and yet Democrats still defending that we have no choice but to continue at this. Why this divide between, in your opinion, between the Republicans who seem to want to say this is not our fight anymore? I don't know if they ever thought it was. But you see this conversation coming out.
Well, I think that first of all, Ukraine has been a political football since long before this war. There were people, there was lobbyists operative in Washington and employing political operatives from both sides. There was the Russian leaning side of the Ukrainian, which Steve Bannon and others were participating with and getting money from. There were the separatists, the nationalist side that were also feeding money. So that there's been this kind of unusual preoccupation with Ukraine and Washington that probably has to do with the willingness of Ukrainians to spend lots of money abroad to affect public policy, number one. Number two, I think that the polarization of our government has become such that if the Democrats say black, the Republicans say white, and vice versa. And so, you know, I'm confident there are plenty of Republicans who are talking about Biden being too soft on Russians and how it is that this would never have happened under Trump because Trump would have been far tougher against Russia. There are others who say, well, no, Trump was in bed with Russia and it would have happened. I think that our foreign policy is formulated in dark rooms, and I don't think I can speak for exactly why things are going as they are, but I think it's perfectly sensible for politicians in Washington to start to be concerned about how we spend $100 billion.
But you know, Sandy, when you have, I think there, and I don't have any way to measure it, but just I believe that there are more Americans who feel like this is the right thing to do than there are who think it's the wrong thing to do.
Well, that's been I've talked about this in prior shows, but I just think that Americans, we got schooled in the Cold War, and it instructed us on how we follow the directions of our government. And patriotism requires that we stand behind combatants, and we stand behind our foreign policy as we announce it. We have a knee-jerk, from the Cold War, we have a knee-jerk antipathy to Russia. I think that an invasion of a country won by the other is a reprehensible thing, but we have sat on our hands when that's happened in the past in other places at other times. And so I think that the problem we have in America is that we are patriots. We do stand up for what our government tells us instructs us to be the patriotic thing to do. And currently our instructions are, subliminally at least, that we have to fight Russia at all costs because Ukraine is the champion of democracy and we have to defend it. We haven't felt that way about we didn't feel that way about Georgia. We haven't felt that way about some other places. And I just think that we can get wound up in our socks on this. And we're going to get wound up in our socks in the same way about Taiwan. Because if you went out and polled people about Taiwan, you'd get the same answer, that we ought to defend Taiwan at all costs.
So, Sandy, is it that we're looking at again because the fact that Ukraine is still a breadbasket and yet it's hard for me to imagine that they'll be able to remain that after what's going on.
Oh, that soil is there. It'll always be there, and it's fantastic soil. The only thing that's damaged it in a permanent way is Chernobyl, to the extent that it spilled its radioactivity over some of that fertile soil. I don't see that as a problem. I think this war is a horrible thing, and I think it is an international crime to invade another country. I just think that we maybe set the table for it. You look back in time, we were looking at in the 60s and talking about JFK. We were ready to push the red button and send missiles because of Russia's intention to essentially occupy Cuba with a military base, okay? And we were talking essentially with our invitation to NATO, to Ukraine, about putting similar bases into Ukraine, which is essentially within Russia, not just 90 miles offshore, but essentially is immediately contiguous to it.
So we've got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. So let me ask you, Sandy. Then,
I'm the man in the mirror to stop the beat. Never hear the naked ball clipper. I'm the man in the mirror to stop the beat. Never hear the naked ball clipper.
847-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, it's kind of amazing to me that we're really involved in this war. We can't say we're not involved in the war, right?
No, I mean, now we've
we're really kind of at war.
Well, we're indirectly, it's a proxy war. There's no question. I mean, we would deny that, I suspect, but it clearly is a proxy war with Russia. We're letting Ukraine fight on with our weapons. We're training them. We're making it possible for them to resist Russia in a way that they could never resist Russia on their own. And that fact is why I think that ultimately we will start to exert back-channel pressure on Ukraine to negotiate, because we don't necessarily, I don't know what our objective is, but Ukraine's objective and our objective might not line up. If Ukraine's objective is to recover Crimea and Sevastopol, then I think we know, Americans know that that is a critical problem for Russia, that Russia would be willing to up the stakes in this war a great deal to make sure that doesn't happen. And so we don't want that to happen. Russia also knows that they can't occupy Ukraine, that would be a disaster in the near term as well as the long term. And so what we've got is the same kind of negotiation that was kind of pregnant, ready to be had when they had Ukraine surrounded. And the main issue, the issue, neutrality of Ukraine, they wanted Zelensky out and a new leader in. They're not going to get that. And then they want to solidify the Crimea and Sevastopol position as being part of Russia, and to settle the Donbas dispute in a fashion that probably recognizes them as autonomous.
You know, Sandy, we as Americans can watch this war. You know, it's almost as if we're not engaged in it, and so it's not priority on any level, I think, in this country. You know, even though the financial resources that we are expending, it's not something that we're really concerned that much about. Everyday life, what's going on in Ukraine is not a major issue with the average American person. But is there a chance that there'll ever come a time when that will happen?
It's become an ideological principle that we have to fight for democracy, okay? And it's become that same sort of ideological principle when we talk about Taiwan. And my concern is about both of them. Is neither one of them reflects a real politic interest. By real politic, I mean the pragmatic politics of international affairs. Neither one of them is important to the United States. And it would only be important to the United States if we have decided that we are willing to invest all of our fortune and put our nation entirely at risk for the welfare of a democracy in another place. And both of those places, Taiwan and Ukraine, have had democracies that are rather suspect. Taiwan has been trending more towards an open government. Ukraine has had an entirely corrupt government, and I don't know the extent of its corruption now, but everyone understood it was a very corrupt government, labeling itself a democracy, as does Russia, in 2014.
So really, Sandy, correct me if I'm wrong, it appears to me that it's not Ukraine or Taiwan. It's the fact that it's our enemies, China and Russia,
yes,
that we are really kind of directing this at.
Yeah, and the only reason that we're particularly up in arms about what happens in those places is because we have decided to define those two countries as our enemies. And like I've said before, that's one of the most fundamental and important policy decisions that is made by our government, which is, who are our enemies? Now, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, it was easy to reach that conclusion. Hitler was a pretty easy one to reach that conclusion about. But in today's world, it's much harder to reach that conclusion, yet we're being led down the path of concluding that these two countries are enemies, which requires then that we begin to make our plans, our military plans, our defense budget plans, our public policy, foreign policy plans, all need to be made with the idea that those people are our enemies. And guess what? They have to make all of their plans and decisions in the same manner. They have to build aircraft carriers if they're China, because they need to have offensive weapons to protect their shorelines.
So we've seen this before with the axis of evil. We kind of know the longer we play this game, sooner or later, it won't be a game anymore.
Well, the longer we beat the war drums, the more likely we will stand up and dance the war dance, okay? And that's the way we are as people. That's the way we are as a country. It's one of our strengths. We do join together and carry out the fights that we believe are important and necessary. But important and necessary are two very fundamental policy issues that we need to make very carefully. And most international affairs experts believe that those policy decisions have to be made based on real, solid security interests and real interests of America, and not based on kind of an ideological fervor, because we have a lot to take care of in our own countries.
Well, Sandy,
I'm not sure that American's version of democracy would ever work in China or should be imposed in China.
And the reason they get away with this is because the American people don't see this as their issue.
Don't see which is what issue. What their foreign policy is?
Yes.
Well, we don't talk about it. And in fact, we stopped talking about it during World War II, because if you were for a conservative approach to where America exercised its muscle, you were called an isolationist, which is a pejorative term. You know, that's not like a neutral term. You're an isolationist. You want to stick your head in the sand. And so isolationism became a very politically unpopular position. And the idea that you would not have an aggressive view about what America's policy ought to be around the world became a bipartisan concept. It was the political third rail. Either you're for America's position in the Cold War, either you're for our defense budget, or you're not a patriot.
But I'm clearly surprised that there are Republicans who are pushing against Ukraine, because normally I would have always thought that conservatives were pro-military.
Well, bless their hearts, actually, and I'm not an isolationist. But when the isolationist movement existed, it was a Republican movement.
You know, so but we're at this juncture that, you know, it's not going away, and we as Americans are going to have to face it. Decisions are going to have to be made, and soon.
Well, my view is that the decision ought to be made in the triage of what the American people need and want for their welfare, including child daycare and preschool education and universal health care and the things that matter. And then the defense budget ought to be calculated within the calculus of priorities that include those things. And my problem with the defense budget today is it's ruled by this kind of machismo approach to international affairs.
All right. I want to thank you, Sandy, as always. I want to thank the listening audience. Thank you, Connor, as always. Happy Dr. King Day. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you tomorrow.